Hello, everyone. I'm Kevin Gastola, managing editor for shadowproof.com, and I'm here with Aaron Sinek, who is a journalist. He's based in Chicago. He covers a lot of activist organizations, protests, rallies. He's covered Chicago politics, and he's here to talk with me about a series that we've commissioned at Shadowproof on the 2019 mayoral election in Chicago. So thanks for joining us, Aaron.
Thank you for having me.
And a lot of people listening probably have more of a national focus. You know, I'm sure that they, whether they want to or not, are fairly occupied with the antics of President Donald Trump, what's going on in the national news, or they're following what's going on in Congress and things involving the border wall, etc. And then here in Chicago, which is kind of, you know, a nice little microcosm of our national politics, especially when it comes to the Democratic Party, we have this mayoral election, and it's got some significance, and we want to talk to you about what makes it significant. But for people who have not been living in Chicago under Mayor Rahm Emanuel for the last two terms, for 8 years, I think it's best to begin before we dive into what the mayoral election will be like and how it might unfold and what are the issues at play. It's important to talk about what has been unfolding. What has it been like for poor and working class Chicagoans? What has it been like for working people or teachers or these or minority communities that are trying to get by on a daily basis? So just why don't you start by trying to set the scene for people on what have been some of the bigger issues over the last 8 years?
Well, I think, you know, folks here for 8 years and for longer, I mean, we could go back, you know, quite a few decades, and that's, but we're not going to. But, you know, it's been a sort of, you know, just people in marginalized communities and people in, you know, working communities, you know, working class folks, I think have suffered greatly, you know, here, you know, during Emanuel's tenure. And a lot of that has been due to his penchant for, you know, taking, you know, essentially privatizing everything, right? You know, and taking resources out of underfunded and, you know, struggling communities and shipping them all downtown to the Loop, to the city center, and to big corporations and frankly, his donors. You know, we've had over 8 years, we saw the largest closure of public schools in, I think, American history. We saw half of the city's mental health clinics closed. We see, you know, something like 40% of the budget goes to policing. And so you've got, you know, we were about to give away more than $2 billion of tax subsidies to Amazon. Like we were ready to do that. And so you've got that sort of neoliberal, you know, 8 years of neoliberalism happening. Meanwhile, and, you know, you brought up, you know, Donald Trump earlier. And I think, you know, that's something worth mentioning, simply that, like, you know, one of his favorite cities to talk about is Chicago. You know, what the hell is going on there? You know, everybody's shooting everybody all the time. And I would go there and I'd be able to fix it and whatever. And, you know, this is a person who's not from here, who's never really been here outside of, you know, downtown and you know, his tower down there, and who even, you know, famously on the campaign trail, just, you know, noped out of a campaign rally he was set to have here. And so I think, you know, from a national perspective, you know, people talk about Chicago and people mostly talk about the violence here and the shootings and whatever, but they don't really talk about any of the root causes for all of that. And those root causes are directly related to the fact that, you know, neighborhoods, you know, most neighborhoods of color, you know, on the South and West sides are starving for resources. You know, their schools are getting closed, their mental health clinics are getting closed. And meanwhile, we're giving these giant tax subsidies to, you know, big corporations to move their business downtown. And the best that a neighborhood can get is maybe like, you know, a Whole Foods. And that, you know, that's more of a sign of a gentrification than it is anything else. And so, you know, we're, it's the kind of thing where you see these kinds of things happening in cities. You look at San Francisco, or you look at some other places where, you know, your housing prices are skyrocketing because people are trying to lure, you know, tech people or whatever, but they're luring them in from out of town. Meanwhile, they're forgetting about the people who actually live here and doing almost nothing for them. So I think that's, you know, sort of what the last at least 8 years or more have looked like. You know, and in addition, you know, we all, I mean, it was a sure bet a while ago that Emanuel was going to run again, until it wasn't. And when he announced that, you know, he wasn't going to run, at that point, he had already raised millions of dollars. And in the previous election, he had raised $25 million. But he was pushed into a runoff. And so you had something like at least a dozen or more people line up to challenge him this round before he said he wasn't going to run. And then once he said he wasn't going to run, that's when some big players and heavy hitters came in, people who have money and infrastructure and whatever, to sort of challenge, you know, to get the seat as well. But I think there's an opportunity here for folks in the city, both, you know, when looking at the mayor's race and looking at, you know, the race for city council. We have, you know, a body here of 50 aldermen. And for the past 8 years, they've been a rubber stamp for Rahm Emanuel's agenda. You know, it's something like 93% of the time they've voted for him in favor of all of these things, which have been absolute disasters for their constituents. So there's a moment here to sort of where we have an opportunity to kind of reshape how things work here from the ground up, from the bottom up. And so there are possibilities. And, you know, I think Chicago is a place that, you know, again, it makes national headlines all of the time for shootings and corruption, but we don't talk about the things that have caused that. And that's what we need to talk about. And we have the opportunity right now, you know, in this election cycle, to really talk about how to reshape these things.
And in your first piece, which was headlined "Chicago Organizers Have a Message for the Next Mayor, Support People's Agenda or Face Resistance," and you can find it at shadowproof.com. You outlined a lot of what you're talking about, and you're setting up a series that's going to dig into many of the issues that captivate Chicago, that impact Chicagoans. And there's just one in particular that I want to make sure we spend some time on. And it sort of, again, sets the scene for what's been happening under Rahm Emanuel. It's only one single case. It's only one example of police violence, but it's had such a huge impact on the city in the past few years. So can you just discuss how the Laquan McDonald case has been a pivotal moment for the Rahm Emanuel administration?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, and for folks who don't know, you know, Laquan McDonald was a, you know, African-American teenager who was shot 16 times by a white police officer here in Chicago back in 2014. And, you know, at first, you know, and that happens frequently here where, you know, people of color are gunned down by cops in their communities. And this particular case, though, there was video footage, there was body cam footage, there was all of that. And it was, I mean, you know, the officer showed up, you know, was on scene for barely a few seconds and literally unloaded an entire clip into this boy. And the footage of that didn't come out until after the election results. And so folks here, you know, for, you know, since then have called that, you know, a cover up. And in those kinds of, you know, that case as it played out, resulted in the firing of then police superintendent Gary McCarthy, who is now a candidate for mayor. And it was, you know, another big black eye for Rahm Emanuel. And by then he had already had several, you know, thanks to the school closings, thanks to the public mental health clinic closures and all of that. And so this was just another example of, you know, the Laquan McDonald case was another example of how there is nearly zero police accountability here in this city, because Laquan isn't the only person. I mean, there are, you know, there are hundreds of names at this point. And, you know, this was the first time, though, that, you know, in decades, that an officer was actually charged with murder and then ultimately convicted of second degree murder, as well as aggravated assault for each shot that he fired. But for years, there was a huge movement that built around that. Like, that was that particular shooting here, I think, was a flashpoint for people who have been fighting for police accountability in this city for decades. It was something to rally around, because this, you know, folks in the communities and folks here see this every single day. And, you know, I think also, you know, this came on the heels of sort of, you know, Michael Brown, and in Ferguson. And so this was, you know, Laquan McDonald was essentially, you know, that was our Michael Brown. That was our Ferguson. That was our hands up, don't shoot. And people, I think, coalesced around it and were able to say, this is a time where we can, you know, get together and start really trying to fight for actual police accountability. And it's a drop in, you know, the conviction is a drop in the bucket, but that started folks talking about, you know, that gave, I think, that put more of a spotlight on, you know, a movement here to get an actual civilian-controlled police accountability board, which, I mean, people have been fighting for a very long time, but, you know, it was tied up in the rules committee, and most people would dismiss it and say, oh, no, that's never going to happen, you know, whatever, because, you know, the police board is a mayoral-appointed body, much like the school board here. And it really, I mean, and most of the time when they investigate, you know, cases of, you know, police misconduct or brutality or whatever, you know, they generally nothing happens. There's no teeth to it. And people here want something, you know, they want accountability. And I think, you know, the saga that developed around, Laquan McDonald really like gave people, something to rally around, and sort of taught and bring the desire for accountability to the forefront, where most of the time it's a thing that people, you know, dismiss or ignore, and have for so very, very long.
In the forthcoming pieces that we publish, you're going to dig into these issues further. You're going to look at police accountability, probably look at disinvestment in neighborhoods, justice in education, and accountability issues, etc. So we'll save that for our future conversations after the pieces that you're going to write. I'd like to talk about the individuals and introduce people to some of the cast members of the 2019 Chicago mayoral election. And these are, you know, to be clear, there are over 20 candidates, right?
That number has dropped a bit. I want to say that there are about 17, somewhere between 15 and 17 now, just because of recent developments. A couple of people dropped out or were pushed out. But yeah, we had more than 20 before things got formalized.
Right, but you have to have petition signatures, you have to do all the work, and you have to actually have functioning campaigns to put anything together. So now we're down to over a dozen, but only about, you know, six or seven are really worth talking about. Is that fair to say that there's probably only like six or seven that really are going to make an impact and are worth focusing on?
I mean, I think there's something to be said for, I mean, there are six or seven people who might have a chance. The reality is, with a field this big, you know, in the way Chicago elections work, the way the mayoral election works, at least, is that you need 50% of the vote plus one to win. If no one gets 50% plus one, then it gets pushed into a runoff between the top two. That is most likely to happen since we have, you know, more than a dozen people running. I think there are, I mean, I don't like to say that it's, you know, not worth talking about some people, but because it is, because they have ideas and, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. But at the same time, there are plenty of people who literally have zero chance of winning. And I think, you know, I talked about this probably a few weeks ago, and I think I've said this a lot of times, which is that, you know, you're going to see as time develops, you know, that field of 20, you know, of two dozen drop down to less than a dozen, because at some point you have to ask yourself, can I win? And if I can't win, why am I doing this? Why am I spending this money? Why am I spending this time? That kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, your top six or so would be worth talking about in more detail.
Well, let's use, and I'll actually source it. I'm not going to claim credit for something I didn't do. I'm going to use the Chicago Magazine's list here. And they have updated, I think it's as of this year. I'm not entirely certain, but if you go to their site right now, they have what they consider the power rankings for the race. And so I'm just going to walk through. I'm going to start from seven. And it's an odd number to begin with, on. And most people would probably be like, take your top five or take your top 10. But I think just based on who is in this race, this is a good starting point because, and also we were talking about these police issues already. So he doesn't stand much chance of gaining momentum at all. But we wanted to talk about what Gary McCarthy represents. He was the former superintendent or Chicago Police Department chief. And as you're talking about, he's not from Chicago. He's from New Jersey. And
New Jersey, New York. Yeah.
Yeah. And so now he's come back to Chicago or he's remained in Chicago, even though he lost his job, and he's put together a campaign.
Yeah. And you know, I wrote about Gary at the beginning of last year in January of 2018 for an outlet called Injustice Today, which is now The Appeal. Just about his tenure here, because Gary started teasing that he was going to run for mayor a long time ago. And before he started teasing his run for mayor, he made the media rounds, but he spent a lot of time on conservative media. And, you know, he is a former police chief, and he was directly involved with the Laquan McDonald shooting, as well as a lot of other cases of misconduct. And, you know, I can't pretend to know anyone's mindset of why they choose to run. But I mean, it might be a fair assumption to say that he may have, and he announced his run before Emmanuel decided to not run. And I think that's important for a lot of these candidates, because there is a set of people who, you know, said that they were going to run against him. And then there was a set of people that came afterward that said, oh, well, now that the field's open, I'm going to jump in. Which I think is an important distinction we could talk about later. But, you know, Gary himself presided over a lot of absolute disasters, you know, here in Chicago that he's directly related to or implicated in. And maybe he was salty about getting fired and, you know, taking the fall for, you know, the fallout from, you know, Laquan McDonald's death. And, you know, I think that's part of, that could have been part of his motivation. But, you know, he's a guy who represents, I think, you know, Chicago's elections are nonpartisan. And Gary has said over and, you know, Gary will still say that he is a Democrat. But I was at a mayoral forum once where, you know, candidates were asked point blank whether or not they voted for Trump. And he kind of pleaded the fifth on that one and didn't say who he voted for. And it's a safe assumption to say that he is much more of a conservative than he lets on. I mean, Chicago might be a Democratic town. But our elections are nonpartisan. It's just, you know, thanks to, you know, years and years of machine politics, you know, it's mostly Democrats that run. But, you know, Gary is a guy who was endorsed by Rudy Giuliani, of all people, earlier this year on Twitter. And it's because of that sort of ham-fisted, heavy-handed, you know, policing that the right wants, which is like, oh yeah, we want a former police chief or whatever to be mayor of this city that we talk shit about so much and that kind of thing, you know, because of violence, because they're looking for that kind of heavy-handed policing with zero accountability and, you know, essentially fascist tactics. However, Gary, being an out-of-towner, has to own his, you know, the kind of thing. So he can say, well, I'm not part of the machine. And he's right about that. And he's also sort of over the past few months, he's been sort of trying to take a more progressive tone by saying, you know, oh, well, yeah, I agree. We, in fact, you know, there's been a big fight here over the fact that, you know, Emmanuel has been trying to greenlit $95 million to build a brand new police academy that includes an Olympic-sized swimming pool and all these other things in a neighborhood that's been starving for, you know, schools and resources for a very long time. And even Gary opposes that cop academy. And that, I think, is interesting because, you know, here you have a guy who, you know, spent a lot of time talking, you know, using conservative talking points, coming out and saying, well, oh, but, you know, I'm also a progressive. You know, I'm also, you know, I don't want this cop academy and I will do accountability and all that kind of thing. And, you know, because I think, you know, people, even he and other people have to, you know, see folks here and say, well, you know, these are things, these are issues that people have been, you know, clamoring for, you know, decades. And we actually have to at least pretend to listen to them. Again, I'm not going to pretend that I know what his actual motivations are, but, you know, it's pretty clear that, like, you know, the former police chief who presided over the Laquan McDonald shooting and fallout from that is not, you know, a more left progressive candidate, no matter what kind of rhetoric he might want to use.
But those words that he's saying about the cop academy would not be spoken if not for the organizing among activists in the city over the last couple of years and sustained activism, even with little to no support from people in the Chicago City Council who do not want to hear from them.
Oh, exactly. I mean, you know, and again, I mean, this goes back to, you know, Laquan, but it goes back before then. You know, there has been a lot of sustained activism here for decades, fighting for police accountability. And, you know, the Cop Academy movement is just one of the latest things about that. I mean, and people have held sit-ins in City Hall, teach-ins in City Hall. Folks have shut down, you know, the streets in both the Loop and in neighborhoods. To say, hey, you know, we don't, you know, you don't have $2 million for mental health clinics, but you have $95 million for a new police academy. Like, there's something wrong about priorities here. And, you know, people would not, if it was not for that sustained activism over the years, and I also have to, I would be doing a disservice if I didn't mention, we are also the first city in America that successfully won getting reparations for victims of police torture, you know, and that was all due to, you know, sustained activism over decades, trying to get justice for the folks who were tortured into giving false confessions by the late John Burge. And you know, so again, it's these kinds of, like, I think people have been, you know, trying to take power for themselves here for years. And we've gotten to a point where, yeah, Rahm Emanuel don't listen and never did. But now it doesn't matter. And now, you know, folks, even people like Gary McCarthy or whoever, see that writing on the wall. And it's like, okay, well, wait, we actually have to at least listen to these folks or, you know, at least pay them some kind of mind. And I think that's a huge amount of leverage that hopefully folks will be able to use over the next 2 months or 5 months, depending on whether or not we have a runoff, to really force, you know, elected officials to not only, you know, to force elected officials to, you know, say that they're going to do these things, but then after they get elected, to actually hold them accountable and make them do what they say.
All right. So another person we need to introduce people to is possibly familiar. He's had a presence on the national stage, You'll definitely recognize the last name because it's Bill Daley, and he's had family that has run Chicago for 43 of the 56 years between 1955 and 2011. So he's part of a dynasty that has ruled Chicago. And so his campaign, how do you view his presence in the race?
I mean, I think that he is sort of, he's like the DCCC's dream, I think, in ways. Like, he's raised the most money out of everyone else. He has, you know, he's already buying lots of TV ads, and he's running a national campaign for mayor, in, you know, he's running a national type of campaign, but for mayor of a city. You know, he's made a lot of broad sweeping promises, but I haven't seen a lot of details, but I see him as sort of like a, you know, a bland Democrat that, you know, has connections to, you know, literally Chicago's dynasty. He is a Daley. But, you know, this is a guy who I think most recently, he made news because he wanted to he's like, it is time to rename the Dan Ryan Expressway for Barack Obama. And it's like, that is some serious pandering, dude. You know, like, I mean, that is like just blatant pandering. Like, you know, we're talking about, you know, we have real issues here, and then we have whatever these things are, and that's what you're going with, man. Like, and so that is the kind of thing where I look at a candidate like that, and I'm just like, no, I'm sorry. Like, I don't, if that's your issue or whatever, you need to actually start listening to people. But, you know, he I think represents, you know, a top down kind of guy.
Could we call him a third term of Rahm Emanuel? Could he be like, I mean, minus the temperament, is he very much similar to Rahm Emanuel?
I don't know if it's fair to say, especially because there is another candidate that's further higher on this list that has been called, you know, by activists and other folks in the community, as a potential third term for Rahm Emanuel. I don't know that Bill, I mean, I think Bill might have a chance of coming in third, given the fact that he has a lot of money. But I don't know that he would actually win in a runoff. But I don't know that he'd be I mean, I think he probably would, though. You know, the more I think about it and the more I kind of babble on here, he more than likely would kind of be a third term of Rahm Emanuel in that, you know, yeah, minus the temperament, he would be a guy who would still continue to, you know, give big, you know, big breaks to corporations. I mean, that's who he's campaigning with. That's who he's raising his money from, is big business. And of course, if you're raising money from big business, you're going to do what big business wants. And I think that is, yeah. So, you know what? I'll say it is a fair assumption.
Okay. And so the next person, who I have to say, I'm pretty unfamiliar with him, even though I live in Chicago, which maybe doesn't speak so well of his campaign. I vaguely think I've heard the name, but again, as somebody who lives in Chicago, he's got an uphill battle because I don't know too much. So Gary Chico.
Yeah, Gary.
Man, go ahead.
Oh, no, go on. I was going to say, it sounded like you were going to ask something.
I'm seeing here that he has been a board president for Chicago Public Schools. I would suggest in our little conversation here that might not necessarily endear him to all of Chicago.
No, it won't. And, you know, there is another candidate further up on the list who was also who was the former CEO of CPS. And I was there, you know, at the Chicago Teachers Union Hall to see him on a debate. And I'll talk about that later. But, you know, it's safe to say that if you've run CPS anytime in the past 20 years, people are not necessarily going to be a fan of you because, holy shit, you know, like that hasn't gone well. Chico, I think, if I remember correctly, he ran two cycles ago, back in 2011, when Emanuel was first elected. And since then, he's sort of just disappeared. I mean, there's a reason why you've lived here and you're not even familiar with the name. And that's because where's that dude been for the past, you know, 8 years? And, you know, I think that's sort of like what he has to sort of answer for or address is the fact that he's mostly, you know, and much like Bill Daley too, like, you know, you look at him, you know, both Daley and Chico, where have they been for the past 8 years and why do they even want to run for mayor? I mean, these are guys who want to be career politicians, and that is the problem. Like, you know, it's a stepping stone to sort of get yourself, you know, if you're mayor of the third largest city in the country, it's a political stepping stone. And I think, you know, I again have to question the motivation of people who have been largely absent from Chicago politics or, you know, Chicago activism for, you know, during Emanuel's tenure, who just show up now and are like, hey, I'm here. You should vote for me. Like, so that's I'll give you that there.
All right, so let's talk about Amara Enya, who is very, very different from any of the prior candidates that we've mentioned. Definitely can distinguish herself. And people might have heard the name. They might have seen Chance the Rapper's endorsement in the news if they caught any news around Chicago. But talk about who she is and what she represents in this race.
Well, I think, I mean, Amara is a person who comes from a very strong public policy background. And Amara's somebody who ran for mayor our last cycle started running in 2014, but was ultimately had to fold her campaign because her petition signatures got challenged by another candidate. And she just didn't have the money or resources to fight that challenge. But she she came out very early in the beginning, you know, months and months ago, and said she was going to run before Emanuel decided he wasn't. And she's a person who has, I think, a much, much deeper and stronger connections to folks in the neighborhoods, particularly on the West Side. So, you know, and she's got a lot of deep public policy ideas. You know, she's talked about, you know, public banks. She's talked about eliminating TIFs. She's talked about, and she's also really stood, or tried to at least, to make strong connections to movements for police accountability and those sort of things. And I think that, you know, that says something. Of course, though, you know, she was considered a long shot candidate for a very long time because she didn't have a lot of money and resources. And then Chance the Rapper stepped up, made that endorsement, and that made headlines. And then after that, Kanye West cut her a huge check so that she could pay off her debt. And that, I think, has been sort of problematic because Kanye is a person who, you know, he's a Trump fan. And, you know, he's also, I'm not even going to, I think folks have seen enough of him in the headlines to make their own judgment, but that has actually been sort of like a thing where people have been like, well, hey, wait, if you're taking money from this guy, what does that mean? And that's something that, you know, she has to answer for, in that sort of way. But she does, I think, represent, you know, a person who has, you know, a little like more deeper connections to some of the marginalized communities here in Chicago that, you know, other people don't. And I think that's a good sign. You know.
And also, as far as age, generationally, she'd be much different.
Oh, yeah. I mean, she's young. In fact, I don't know how old she is off the top of my head, but she might be younger than I am. And I think that says something. I mean, I'm granted I'm old now, but, you know, she's younger, and she and that's the thing. I think she connects with younger people, and she knows how to. You know, I covered her campaign launch party, and you know, there most of the folks there were younger. They were mostly people of color, and I think that's, you know, that shows that, you know, I mean, because people always say like, oh, well, millennials, even though millennials are now in their, you know, middle aged practically, but young people don't care about politics or elections. And I think, you know, her campaign and the folks who are coalescing around it prove that theory wrong.
I'm seeing that Amara is 35 years old. And so, yeah.
I am older than her. So.
All right. So the next candidate that I'm looking at, and I have to be blunt, he looks like a clone of Tom Perez, who's running the Democratic National Committee right now. or maybe a white clone. I do have to question if whether the establishment of the Democratic Party has these like clone people they're going to be rushing out to stave off the revolution from the people out there who are supporters of Bernie Sanders, because he definitely looks like somebody they'd deploy. But that's a side thing. So Paul Vallis is someone who could be a contender. I don't know too much about him, but I will say that, like, out of the blue a few days ago, my wife and me got a spam message from him. We had no idea how he got our number. He just sent some kind of thing to us. And I was like, who's Paul Vallis? I've never heard of you. And then I went and I looked and I saw he's been endorsed by Obama. He's been, or I don't know if he's been endorsed, but Obama, Bill Clinton, some of these other people have said favorable things about him. He seems to have favorable things from newspapers here in Chicago that are speaking about him. So who is he and what does he represent?
Well, I mean, you know, I think he was the one that I was talking about earlier. I went to a mayoral forum that was very specifically about divestment and the displacement of African-American communities here in Chicago and other marginalized communities here in Chicago as well. And he ended up on that panel because another candidate who they basically put together, I think it was five or six people to talk about these issues at the Chicago Teachers Union Hall. And he wasn't initially on it, but the person who had just beat him out of the poll as to how they organized it had dropped out of the race. So he was the next in line. And he is the former CEO of Chicago Public Schools. And let me tell you, that room, he got booed the second he spoke. And I think that says something where it's like, you know, yeah, he has a lot of favorable things that have been said about him by, you know, superstar politicians. But the reality is he also presided, you know, over CPS, and he was no friend to teachers. He was no friend to, you know, students in marginalized communities. And I think folks here remember that. And then also, yeah, the spam messages, I think everyone here has gotten them and no one knows how he got their phone numbers. And so, again, you know, this is somebody who I think, you know, is a very top down person who, you know, literally defended his tenure at CPS, even though, you know, he left that, you know, in his closing remarks. He says, well, you know, I'm going to close on my tenure as CEO of CPS. And, you know, again, there were audible boos and laughter. Like, nobody could believe that he was doing that given what's happened over the past, you know, over the past few years. And so I think, you know, again, this is something where you've got a person who, you know, important and well-known, you know, people and politicians like this person, but, you know, folks from the neighborhoods remember her. And I think that is something that, you know, he has to address, you know, as far as, you know, his tenure running CPS. And that's, you know, that's that.
Well, I'd just like to take a moment to thank people who have listened so far. There's a bit more that we want to talk about, but I guess for people who have been listening, I want to say thank you for digging into this conversation. And, you know, we really could use your support if you like what you're hearing from Aaron, if you want to see this kind of journalism. We're raising money. We have been pitching people who are our members. We've been going out to people who have donated before to Shadowproof and asked them to support Aaron's wonderful work on Chicago and politics, and also highlighting the work and organizing of grassroots voices, etc. And so that's my way of admitting that, like, we're getting in. This next part is an important introduction to two key candidates, but we might also be wading into some of the more I guess, swampy parts of Chicago politics, because I think inevitably we're going to be talking about Alderman Ed Burke. Because I'm just seeing here that both Susana Mendoza and Tony Preckwinkle have their own connections to this corruption scandal, and they may be the two front runners, and they may be the two people who end up going into a runoff in Chicago. We don't know, but the Chicago Magazine seems to think that these are going to be the two people who go into a runoff when all is said and done. So let's unwind this a bit. Let's first start off by, what do you think Susana Mendoza represents?
Well, I mean, I think it's, you know, there are criticisms that I have heard. On the one hand, okay, we can actually talk about both Mendoza and Preckwinkle, because on the one hand, you have two women of color who are the top front runners for the mayor's race. And I think that's amazing. I think that's great. I think folks here see that too and are like, hey, finally, you know, someone who's not a white dude. That's amazing. You know, that hasn't happened in quite a few decades here. But I think with Mendoza is that one, as you said, you know, she won her first seat in the state legislature with the help of Ed Burke, who is now being indicted for extortion. So there's that. But she also, as recent as November, on her campaign website, she mentioned Burke's name a couple of times, she's, deeply rooted in Chicago and, he was her mentor and all of this stuff. And once the FBI raided his offices, all of that stuff disappeared very quickly. So there's that. But also there are people who are connected to her campaign or who have been consulting with her, giving her advice, who worked for Rahm Emanuel. And so the criticism that, I've heard from folks is that, she very well could be, another Rahm Emanuel simply because she has such tight connections with Emanuel. And that is, that's a problem. And then in addition to, she was called out by Preckwinkle at that particular forum I was talking about earlier when I was talking about Vallis for her support of the death penalty. And so I think, despite the movement and all of that, those are real questions and real things that she would have to answer for, the connections to Burke and the connections to Emanuel, and how she's going to be a different, something different, than what we've already had.
And then introduce people a little bit further to Tony Preckwinkle, and then let's talk about it in the context of the fact that SEIU and the Chicago Teachers Union did take the step of endorsing Preckwinkle already.
Yeah, very, very early. I mean, Tony Preckwinkle has been the Cook County Board President and jumped into the race. And again, I think this is something to be said for both Mendoza and Preckwinkle, is that they did not announce their runs until Rahm Emanuel decided he was going to step down. And I think that that is something that, both of those folks should answer for, because right out the gate, that sends a message that says, oh, well, I wasn't really interested in doing this unless it was viable for me. So how much do you actually care? I mean, Preckwinkle has been a person who I think has been, in Chicago politics, in county politics for a very long time. And I think, and has experience, and that's great. And again, she's a woman of color who has a record of working with folks on police accountability. She's made some steps here and there with that. And I think those are good things. But again, it is interesting that, she is Labor's candidate. SEIU has several locals here in Chicago, and the first local endorsed her literally, I think, the day that she had her launch party. And then the other locals followed, along with the Chicago Teachers Union. And I think that's a thing where, Labor will look at a candidate and, Labor's not going to endorse somebody if they don't think they have a shot at winning. And so I think that's why you saw those endorsements, because, you know, that's, you know, she's a person who I think that they have worked with for a long time in the past. And, you know, she said the right things to the CCU and all of that. You know, she supports an elected school board and all of that, which I think is, you know, those are all good things. But again, you know, she has connections to Ed Burke as well. You know, and she's, you know, she threw out a lot of petition challenges to try to knock people off the ballot. And, you know, those are all things that are your typical sort of Chicago machine politics. And so that is, you know, that's a thing that folks need to look at as well. But, you know, I will say that, you know, labor has always challenged, or well, some labor, the CTU and SEIU specifically. I shouldn't say all labor, because Emmanuel had plenty of support from other unions like the IBEW and other people in other elections. But, you know, at both SEIU and the CTU heavily backed Chuy Garcia, who was Emmanuel's challenger last cycle and who successfully pushed him into a runoff, at least. And so I think, you know, there was a movement here for a time to get him to run again. But, you know, he just won his seat in Congress. So, you know, he ultimately decided not to do that. So I think, you know, when those unions looked at that endorsement, they were looking for another person who was similar to the agenda that he had. And I think, you know, Preckwinkle is that connection there.
And it also may be that she's somebody they could count on to invite them to the table to talk about policy issues that are important to their unions. And so,
well, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think she is somebody who's, you know, she's worked with those unions in the past, and those are unions, especially the CTU. You know, that's a union that has fought with Rahm Emanuel for, you know, his entire term. You know, not only via the school closures, but also, you know, we had the first teacher strike we had in a couple of decades, you know, during Emanuel's tenure. And so, you know, and also Emanuel has, you know, never supported an elected school board and those kinds of things. And so I think Preckwinkle represents a person who will be more progressive on those issues than Emanuel, and will be willing to work with folks more so than the other people. I mean, again, you know, I mean, we could go down the list of, you know, the 15 candidates, and, you know, is there someone that, you know, they might have liked or might have endorsed? Possibly. But again, they're not going to put their money and their memberships and their support behind somebody that they don't think is going to win. Because, you know, people like, you know, people who do that kind of thing, you know, they want a safe bet. And I think Preckwinkle is the safe bet for both, you know, coming from a campaign investment perspective from unions, but then also from knowing that, like, this is a person who's going to work with us. And I think that's actually, I mean, I think that's good in that, you know, anybody whoever's running the ship here needs to work with, you know, labor, especially work with the CTU, because they are a huge force here in Chicago, and they've been, you know, fighting for not only their teachers, but also their students, you know, in an environment where, you know, I mean, I think it's 3 out of 4 public schools don't even have libraries. And that's a problem. And so I think, you know, we need somebody who's going to work, you know, in general to rectify that. And I think that's what they see in Tony Preckwinkle.
All right. So for those listening, if you didn't turn us off yet because we were still rambling on and on, I'm going to give you all insight into who Ed Burke is, because for those people who do not live in the city of Chicago, maybe they saw the FBI had raided Burke. Maybe they saw that he was indicted, and they don't really know how he features in Chicago politics. But as you were saying, he's been a fixture here, almost half a century that he's been some part of the Chicago political scene. And so, yeah, just so everyone's clear on who he is before we wrap. You know, what has he represented in Chicago for the last half century?
I mean, he has represented corruption, the Chicago machine, racism, all of these things for the last 50 years. I mean, Burke has a very, very, very long history here. And it goes back for longer than I've been alive. You know, and, you know, it's interesting. I had a friend of mine and former coworker in journalism talk to me yesterday. And he made a really great comparison by saying, you know, Ed Burke getting indicted for extorting a restaurant for tax appeal work is like Al Capone being convicted for tax evasion. Both have done far worse. And, you know, I mean, this is a person who, you know, he is stonewalled attempts to create an investigative body to investigate city council members. You know, he racked up an incredible bill for bodyguards, $600,000 for bodyguards for him. He lives in a three-story mansion in his ward. he also led the charge for a Blue Lives Matter type city ordinance here that would, you know, that sort of thing. And he's been the target of ethics investigations for conflicts of interest with his law firm, which is exactly what he's been indicted for. He was part of ghost payrolling back in the 90s. He was also part of the council wars where, you know, when Harold Washington, you know, Chicago, you know, a black Chicago mayor, you know, city council people like Burke and others tried to fight his efforts back in those days. To fix things. He's also, I mean, literally, this is a guy who had his streets plowed five times after a snowstorm. And so, you know, I think that, you know, him being indicted is a pretty big deal, especially because he's also the chair of the Finance Committee here in Chicago. And, you know, that is one of the most, that is the most powerful position in city council when you're the guy who decides where the money goes. And so there's finally, you know, he's successfully beaten back every investigation, every query or whatever into him. And whether or not, you know, he survives this one is anyone's best guess. I mean, again, his wife is also a judge. So there's that as well. And so I think that right there represents, you know, that, you know, he represents the machine. He represents, you know, corruption, you know, and all of that in Chicago politics. And, you know, now there's and despite all of this, you know, even after, despite his history and despite, you know, his offices being raided by the FBI, 1,000 people still showed up to a fundraiser for him at $150 a pop after his offices were raided by the FBI. And so that just sort of says how powerful this man is. And, you know, he's what, 74, 75, something like that. And he's still going to run for, you know, he's still, he hasn't, as of today, at least, he's still, you know, planning on running. He's still running for alderman. You know, and I think that says something. I mean, there, you know, that says something about politics in general, I think, is that you have folks like this who literally, it's like, you know, it's the tyranny that everyone knows. It's the you know, it's an open secret, you know, how, you know, what this person's about, and yet they still have power. And I think, you know, he's a great example of how there are so many people on all levels in all governments, be they city, be they, you know, state, be they national, be they a president, that are, you know, so corrupt, but they're so powerful that they're able to get away with whatever the hell they want. And I think that if this, you know, if he does get brought down by this investigation, by this charge, or if it, you know, harms, you know, his potential to be elected again, I think that also shows a shift, in at least politics here locally, that like, hey, maybe, you know, people are starting to get some power, and I think that's good. It's just a question of whether or not it's enough.
And just so we do make this tidbit of a note, you're probably the only person who I'm going to be talking to about this. I don't have another show or another outlet to just mention this. So I want to be clear with people that apparently the Burger King that is part of the indictment's the same one. There's corruption involving this Burger King here in Chicago. It's the same location where there were issues over missing footage in the Laquan McDonald case.
It is. It is the same. And there is something to be said for that. And I think there is something to be said, you know, as well, I mean, just because Ed Burke is a former cop as well. And there's also something to be said for the fact that they pulled 23 guns out of his office. And so you can kind of, I mean, it was the Burger King, you know, he shook down the Burger King that had the footage of Laquan McDonald being killed for money. And I think that that, you know, again, when we talk about, you know, corruption in Chicago politics and when we talk about police accountability, this is the problem here is that, you know, this is a person who is the, you know, one of the most powerful people in the city who's done this kind of level of corruption and gotten away with it time and time again. And that is, I think, you know, something that, you know, I don't even know who answers for that, except for himself. But this is somebody who should not be running things and still is. And I think hopefully we have an opportunity to rectify that this election. Well, at least we can hope.
All right. The election is scheduled for February 26th. There are several weeks, a little less than 2 months, and we're going to be talking to you periodically as you publish the rest of your series. You've got one up, as we mentioned, at Shadowproof already. It sets the stage for the next five pieces, which are going to delve into issues that people are grappling with during this election. And where some of the campaigns might fit in, etc. We'll let people see what you do. And again, thank you for talking with us. Thank you for doing this work for us. We really appreciate it, Aaron.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me and letting me do this. I really appreciate it, too, because I think, you know, I mean, you know, so many people cover elections, you know, in the terms of horse races. And, you know, I'm very, very happy to be able to cover this, you know, from a sense of, you know, coming from community organizing perspectives, coming from activist perspectives, coming from the people who've been fighting the fight here for a very long time, you know, those folks need a voice. And, you know, I'm not saying that I am, but I'm at least, you know, happy to be able to sort of come at it from that perspective rather than a top-down perspective. And I thank you guys for working with me on this because, you know, it's been great. And, you know, hopefully people will get some value out of it.